Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to all of our returnees and new friends. Bruchim Habayim, welcome and happy Chanukah. It's a very special day, first day of Chanukah this year, and so we're happy to share this afternoon together. We're going to change the format very slightly to welcome a special guest, so I'm happy to co-present today with my colleague, Rabbi Yaakov Danishevsky, who is running so much of this project that we call the Midwest Center for Jewish Learning. So we're very excited that he's here to share some wisdom with all of you. And I also want to shift a little bit in terms of the direction of how we usually look at issues in this group. The purpose of this group is to explore spiritual resistance in the Holocaust. And for those who are new, about every 6 weeks we get together and we pick a different city. And through that city, we explore spiritual and religious resistance. So the city that we're using today is Rome, but we're actually not going to talk about Rome at all. I wanted to use it as a point of departure to talk about an issue that is headquartered in Rome, and to actually think about it from the opposite perspective of what we usually think about it. I want to talk about Italian Jews together a little bit, which I'm thinking in my mind, in terms of the permanent exhibit, I'm not sure that there is a specific station where we have a discussion about Italian Jews. On the left side in the alcove, there's a discussion about French Jews, right? When you go around the corner before you get to the ghettos. Somewhere. And I'm actually not going to talk about the Catholic Church at all today. That's not going to be part of the focus, because that's a whole world unto itself, the role of the Catholic Church in the Holocaust. But it's interesting that Italian Jews had a different experience in the Holocaust than many other European Jewish communities. In the early 1930s, there were about 40,000 Jews living in Italy, and they had lived there, you know, for many, many centuries. The Italian Jewish community is one of the oldest Jewish communities. Some even have a tradition that when Jews were expelled from Israel in the First Temple period, they came directly from Israel to Italy, and that's why there were, let's say if you go to Israel today, you go to Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem, there is a synagogue there, the Italian synagogue, that has some very specific old customs. Those somewhat quixotic customs are specifically Italian Jewish customs that come from very, very ancient traditions. So the Italian Jewish community has been there for many, many years. And Mussolini had been there also for quite a few years. Mussolini was appointed by the king. There was a king in Italy. His name was King Victor Emmanuel. And he appointed Mussolini in 1922. But at this point, Jews were doing pretty well. And even though Mussolini and his fascist chevra, many of them were very, very anti-Semitic, nothing was really a problem until 1938, when they created these anti-Semitic laws that involved defining Jews and removing Jews from government jobs, similar to kinds of things that you found in the Nuremberg laws in Germany. Yeah?
You're too young to remember, but there's a bunch of us who might remember the movie in the Garden of Vinci. That was about Jews in Italy during the Shoah.
Okay, that's before my time, but Roberto Benigni is not before my time. So for those who saw that movie, Life is Beautiful, that's a very special experience to watch that movie. It's very moving. It's very telling. It's very interesting in terms of human nature. But we'll hold that for a second. So Jews were removed from various positions, and then at the outbreak of the war, of course, shortly thereafter, the Italians joined the Germans in the Axis, fighting the Allies. But still, primarily, you're talking about apparently about 4,000 Jews, 40,000 Jews in Italy at the outbreak of the war. The Italian authorities primarily did not cooperate with Germans the same way that other local communities did in many places in Eastern Europe. It was only until 1943 when Mussolini was removed, and then the Germans stepped in and created this new government, and then they installed Mussolini, but he was basically a puppet for the Germans, who set up their own, you know, their own SS activities to start deporting Jews. But at the end of the day, all told, there were less than 10,000 Jews who were deported from Italy over the course of the Holocaust.
Totaling about 10,000 Jews.
8,000
The plurality of those went to Auschwitz. The majority went to a host of other camps in different places. And some of you are familiar with Primo Levi. So that's an example of an Italian Jew. And there's another one that I have at home. I'm trying to remember. I can't remember off the top of my head. Another one of these descriptions. But what you find is that unlike other communities where there was a higher proportion of collaborators, here you had many Italians who were protecting Jews, even when the Germans were hunting for them, even during the later years. And that's why you have one of the high survival rates. Out of 40,000 Jews, to think that three quarters of them survived, imagine what that number would be like in other countries.
Yeah. The hologram that's showing, at least it was showing before, is Adina Sella, who is a survivor from Italy.
So that brings about the issue that we're going to discuss today, which is, what was it about Italians? Why is it that many of them did save Jews? And how would Jews view the same question in reverse? Which is something that we don't often focus in this group, but I want to discuss it with you today together. So I'm going to give you two examples of people, and I don't have good analogies here because I'm not necessarily right now in the world of culture, but I want to introduce to you two people. Turn the page to the first page in your packet, to what you could argue, and who you could argue may have been the greatest conductor of the 20th century, Arturo Toscanini. Toscanini, for many years, was the conductor of the New York Philharmonic and other orchestras around the world. There were two different biographies, and the reason I brought you this is a book review from June of this year by Robert Gottlieb, and he's reviewing a book called Toscanini, Musician of Conscience, by Harvey Sachs. Toscanini was amazing. I'm trying to think of a good reference. So, as somebody who is more familiar with sports than I am with conductors, Toscanini is like the Tom Brady of music. You have to call this the truth the truth. He's like the Joe Montana. Thank you.
How about Sandy Koufax?
Great. He was the man in the world of music for many decades. Arguably the greatest conductor of the 20th century. Many decades spanning everywhere. Toscanini had a very colorful life outside of his musical accomplishments, which are ridiculously long. If I'm not saying that this is authoritative, but if you look, the website Wikipedia has like a tally of his musical accomplishments. It's like 17 pages long. The New York Philharmonic this past year did a whole evening special because it was recognizing, I think it was 125th birthday of Toscanini. Toscanini is a giant in the world of music. And one interesting facet of Toscanini's life, which is mentioned here in the title, which is why I chose this, the title of this book, which I did not read because I just came across this recently, Toscanini, Musician of Conscience. Toscanini wrote a letter to arguably the most powerful political leader in the 1930s. And he told him, I will not play in your city, and I will not conduct your orchestra because of your policies. And that man's name was Adolf Hitler. So in this book review, they give you one little snapshot. Toscanini had a lot of extramarital social activities, and they list some of the women, several dozen. I don't get into that. What eventually undermined the relationship, this is one of the women that he had an affair with, was not their geographical separation, but his increasing distaste, then disgust, for her political leanings and casual anti-Semitism. You hurt me when you say you don't love the Jews, that you don't love the Jews. Tell me rather that you don't love the human race.
he wrote to her in 1939. He had been deeply moved by his experience 3 years earlier when, at no fee and paying his own expense, he inaugurated what would become the Israel Philharmonic. By that time, he was famous throughout the world for his implacable hatred of fascism and Nazism. One of the many ways he demonstrated his hostility to Mussolini was his defiance of the law that the fascist party anthem, Giovinezza, it's probably mispronounced, be played at the start of every public performance. In response, in 1931, he was beaten by fascist thugs outside the opera house in Bologna, and his passport was taken from him. Only in the face of an international outcry was it returned. And then at the bottom, you see, this is a picture of him with a man by the name of Bronislav, what's that?
Huberman,
exactly, who was the world's greatest violinist, who created what was to become the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. And on the left, on the right, you actually see this is a Xerox copy of the original program from the first concert of the Palestine Orchestra. You see the program, and it's signed Arturo Toscanini, season 1936-1937. So I'm not going to take more time on this, but if you want to see more about it, there is an amazing, incredibly inspiring, gotta watch this film by PBS called Orchestra of Exiles. Fantastic, right? Some of you saw it already. Amazing film. Amazing. Amazing. Orchestra of Exiles. And Toscanini plays a big part of this. So this would be like imagining... Huberman is kind of like the beginning to end overarching narrator, kind of the figure, but a big section of it focuses on Toscanini, because without Toscanini, they would have never made it. It was like Tom Brady volunteering to play quarterback for your local, pick up high school game for free for a year. It's amazing. And they describe there how he turned down Hitler for a public protest about what these people were doing. And he said, why? Because it's not an affront to Jews, it's an affront to the human race. Because Jews are people. One more example. Next page. This is from the website of a museum, which I cannot read one word of, because it's in Italian, and the original website does not have an English translation. So if you're good in Italian, this is great, or find a friend or an enemy who doesn't mind taking a few minutes to teach you about this man, Gino Bartali. Once again, you're talking about the man who won the Tour de France multiple times, Italy's biggest cyclist, most famous, most accomplished cyclist. But what's his real story behind the scenes? So he was involved in rescuing Jews, in hiding Jews, and in smuggling papers. Because, as you can imagine, he spent many hours cycling throughout Italy. He would ride hundreds and hundreds of miles. And in the frame of his bicycle, he had forged papers that he would bring from one place to another to find ways to get Jews out of Italy. He even once rode with a trailer on the back of his bike. And when he got stopped, someone said to him, why do you have a trailer? He says, it's part of my training. And in the trailer on the bottom, there was a hidden Jew who he was escaping from Italy. Here also, I forgot the name and I didn't write it down. Nachum and I once watched an unbelievable documentary about him. It gets you emotional without words. He was not Jew. He was a very observant, devout, frum Catholic. But his son asked him, why did he do this? Because he says, that's what you have to do. These people are people.
Toscanini
was not Jewish either. Neither of them were Jewish. That's exactly the point. These people were not Jewish at all. Yes?
So there's a fabulous book that I listened to on audio, and it's called Beneath the Scarlet Sky, and it's all about this. It's based on a true story. It's historical fiction. It's by Mark Sullivan, and I can't remember the main character's name because it was a few audio books ago, but it's based on his life and taking Jews over at 17 years old, bringing them over into Switzerland, and from Italy, and it talked about all of this, and and the Nazis and Mussolini and everything. It's really
what's it called again?
Beneath a scarlet sky.
Okay.
And what's interesting about this and what you're talking about, you asked a question in the beginning, is why did these Italians save Jews? You know, regardless of how, you know, the Pope and the Catholic Church, the priests in Italy, they really felt like, you know, you need to save a life. It doesn't matter if they're Jewish or not Jewish. Those churches, like they, this kid went to live, because they were poor, he went to live with a priest, and then he saw he was a strong kid, and he first had him practice climbing over the Alps into Switzerland. He did all these practice routes, and the kid didn't even know why. He just told him, you need to climb and try this path. And then after so many months, they started taking Jews across, and then all the stuff. So the thing is, though, I think there were networks of priests,
yes,
throughout that actually had close contacts with the Nazis too. Like they would come and talk to them, and Mussolini and everything. Like that network, they felt like we need to save. I feel like they were upstanders and they picked up and
absolutely
tried to save as many as possible.
Absolutely. If you watch this documentary, is useless because I didn't tell you the name of it.
The one about
Bartali.
I think Bartali was mentioned in this too, in this book, because
this guy was the most famous Italian athlete in the 1930s and 40s. The most famous Italian athlete. So it describes, and they did, they took pictures and interviews. He would go from, there were a lot of convents involved when they were hiding Jewish children. So that was some of the places where they would go and hide people. So I actually give you, from the next page, you have a write-up from Yad Vashem. He was inducted into the Righteous Among the Nations, Gino Bartali, I think in the early 80s. And so Yad Vashem has a whole write-up on their website where they describe the people who were saved and influenced by his life. So these people were willing to do the ultimate in terms of courage and heroism and sacrifice, because, you know, if you wouldn't be the most famous Italian athlete, he would have certainly been picked up by the Gestapo. But no one wanted to mess with him because he's the most famous guy around. So who's going to start, you know, asking questions? And Toscanini also, even when they beat him up, there was enough international pressure that you weren't going to start up with Toscanini. Although Toscanini did have to flee Italy before the war, he did run away. That's how he ended up in New York. But I wanted to think about it from the reverse, which is, well, how would Jews think about non-Jews? Right? The first part is recognizing how many non-Jews were upstanders, as you would say, were people who did rescue. And you, if you want to think about where you would use this on the tour, so after the crematorium section, when you go kind of make that right, you swing around where the Raoul Wallenberg section is. So this would be a great time to talk about this in terms of people who were well-known, the most well-known in the world of art and culture, who were upstanders, who were involved in rescuing. But what about, how would the Jews react in a similar situation? Yes.
I just looked it up. It's called My Italian Secret.
There you go. Thank you. My Italian Secret. Thank you. That's the name of the movie. That's it. Thank you.
And also,
yes.
That is, it's a very modern building, and the neighbors were very upset when they built their building because it was originally the Tuscanini mansion.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Trivia. So I wanted to share one perspective, and then Rabbi Danishevsky will share a different one. And the perspective I'm going to share is from an Italian Jewish scholar. There was a man, his name was Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, which is on your last page here, which is what we're going to focus on for a few minutes. He's known colloquially as the Sforno. He lived in Bologna and other communities in northern Italy in the 17th century. And he was a highly educated and acculturated individual. On the one hand, he was firmly committed to Judaism. He was a great rabbinic scholar. But he was also somebody who was generally educated. In general, Italian Jews over the centuries were highly educated. Many of them were actually assimilated. But many of them, even those traditional ones, were also very educated. And there were several very prominent rabbinic authorities who you'll find if you open up any halachic Jewish law work, Maharik, Rabbi Yaakov Kolon, and Rav Ovadia Bartanura, and others. There are some, you know, very prominent names. Italian Jews also played a big role in Jewish scholarship and Jewish learning. But this figure, the Sforno, is important in the world of what we call Parshanut in Hebrew, in understanding of the Chumash. So he wrote a Pirush, a commentary, which is, on the one hand, it is what we would call in Hebrew Pshat. It's focused on the primary understanding of the text. That's what we call in Hebrew Pshat, Pshuto Shel Mikra, the primary understanding of the text. But it adds, there's a kind of a hint of ethical teachings. So it happens to be, I have a family connection here. This translation was authored by Rabbi Ralph Pelkovitz. He is my wife Nechama's grandmother's husband, so I called him today. He's in his mid-90s, now past mid-90s, thank God. And I told him, I said, I'm going to a class and I'm going to be sharing a good edition of the translation of the Sforno. So he liked that. So I said, why did you like the Sforno? So he said, because this synthesis of simple pshat, of understanding the text, but an add of a of an ethical dimension, of a Musar dimension, is something that many later rabbinic figures, he's a prominent rabbi, was a rabbi for over 60 years, so he said that resonated a lot with him because he comes from the Musar school. So here you have kind of like an ethical perspective. And that really can give you an insight into this introductory piece that we're going to study together now for a few minutes. The Sforno is writing a commentary on the five books. He has one introduction to the whole five books, and now he has just one introduction on the book of Bereshis, the first of the five books. So in here, he presents to us his view. It's not the only view, but I think it's an important view of how Jews see non-Jews, how we as, you know, religious people should see the rest of the world. And to do that, he uses a baseball analogy. Now, he doesn't know anything about baseball, and he doesn't call it a baseball analogy, but the best way to remember this is a baseball analogy. What's the baseball analogy? The simplest rule in baseball, even for those people who don't know much about sports, how many strikes do you get in a baseball at-bat?
Three
strikes. It's these three strikes and you're out rule. That's what the Sforno teaches you. Rav Ovadia Sforno says, listen, I'm going to tell you now what I think is the story, the narrative of this book, the book of Genesis that we're reading right now. It's the book of creation, the creation of the human being. And when God created humanity, he wanted all of us, every single creature, because every creature, every human being is created in the image of God, has a spark of godliness within. He wanted us to be emissaries of God. We're partners with God. We're supposed to bring godliness into the world and mend it. So that's what he describes here. He wanted to create the human race, to create kindness, loving kindness. So what did he do? Let's go to the third paragraph, right-hand kind. He, the Blessed One, created man in his image after his likeness that he might choose to imitate his maker to the extent possible. And that way we can better ourselves and better the world. Well, what happened? Unfortunately, if you go to the bottom of the column, when everything was created, man made a huge mistake. What happened? First, we have Adam's two sons getting into a fight, and one of them kills the other. Then you have, in the beginning of Parshas Noach, the section of Noach, people are treating each other with treachery. They're stealing, they're grabbing, they're molesting. So Hashem says, oh, this is not going good. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to press the reset button. We're going to bring a flood. Let's try this one more time. Let's get everybody back on the same page, all humankind. Everybody's going to be the emissary of God. And then we have the third issue, which is what we call the Tower of Babel, which is beyond the scope of our conversation right now, which is a third calamity that befalls humanity, where again, God gives us an opportunity to build something of ourselves and of society, and instead, according to an incredibly powerful interpretation of the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin of the 19th century in Volozhin, he says what we had was a totalitarian state where everyone was controlled by one man with watchtowers, and if you didn't believe what this man believed, guess where you got thrown? According to the Midrashic tradition, where?
Off the tower.
Right? Into the fiery furnace or off the tower. So after this, God says, you know what? We have a problem. This is called three strikes, and you're out. It's not working that the entire world should be emissaries of God. We're all children of God, but it's just not working out. So you know what we need to do? Let's do the following. Let's choose just one person, one family, and we'll give them the special extra responsibilities of being the direct emissaries of God, and hopefully they can pull it off, and by them pulling it off, they can model and connect it to other people. That's why, the Sforno explains, immediately after the Tower of Babel, we are introduced to, who comes on the scene? That's right, Abraham. Because Avraham Avinu, in Hebrew, Abraham our patriarch, he is the answer to the strikeout of humanity. God doesn't say, you know what, we're going to forget the rest of humanity. No, we're going to keep humanity out there. We'll give them, let them have the seven Noahide laws. But it's not working that everybody's going to be held to this high standard. Let's pick one group. We can pick three generations, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If they can pull it off, they'll keep it for their family, and their family will share these values with the rest of humanity. And ultimately, when we come back to the redemption, the period where all of humanity recognizes godliness, it's almost like coming back to the beginning of the story, where all mankind were emissaries, were worshiping Hashem, they were following godliness and perfecting the world. That's what it's ultimately all about. And this follows a phrase that appears in the Torah in different ways, that the Jewish people are referred to as B'ni B'chori Yisrael. My children, the firstborn children. The firstborn children of God. Why is that an important image? Because Hashem has blessed our family with five children. We have an oldest child, he's a Bechor, means he's our firstborn son. That means, according to Jewish law, in theory, if we left everything alone after 120 years, when time is up and our assets would be divided, he would get twice as much as everybody else, and he gets other special things. So he's the Bechor. He's the firstborn. And he takes that pretty seriously. He does not mind, as some of the people in this room know, he's very happy to be the Bechor. What happened if one Shabbos afternoon, we're sitting at the Shabbos table, the kids are playing outside, they're going outside, we have our company, everything is very nice, and this is just theoretical. Theoretically, my oldest son would walk in the door, come through the kitchen, into the dining room, and just kind of like nonchalantly say that, yeah, our second son, and this second son has made more than one trip to the ER, so if God forbid it was him, it wouldn't be like the biggest shocker. He's the one who's made multiple trips. So my oldest son would say, and again, Hashem should protect all of them, but let's say he said, yeah, well, you know, he fell off the swing set and cracked his head open, and, you know, it's going to be a rough afternoon for him. And he just kind of walked off and went to his room to read a book. Herb, you're thinking that's not good. And I would run out, I would get out from the Shabbos temple and say, what is your problem? Your brother is lying outside, you said he cracked his head open, God forbid. And you know what he would say? He would say, you know what? I don't really care because I'm the Bechor. No. I'm going to get twice as much at the end of the day anyway, so why would I care? He's just a simple son. I'm the Bechor, I get twice. So let's just say, thank God that never happened, because if it did, he would never see an electronic device like in perpetuity.
No screen time.
None. No PS4, no I, anything. No I, no we, nothing. What kind of a kid is that? That would be the most depressing thing to hear as a parent. Then one child could care less that the other one fell off the swing set, God forbid. So when the Torah tells us, B'ni B'chori Yisrael, the Jewish people are the oldest child, that means that the oldest child has to be the most responsible, and he has to take care of the younger children. And if he sees a kid falls off the ladder on the swing set, so of course he should go inside and find a gauze pad and get some help and take care of the other children. Doesn't mean that the other children are worthless. So what the Sforno is teaching us is that ultimately all of humanity are supposed to be emissaries of God, and the Jewish people have a higher responsibility, they are accountable, to make sure that they keep this message, they keep the light, if you're going to use a good Hanukkah analogy, they keep the light of that message burning on the outside so that everybody sees it, that we should illuminate the darkness for everyone, not just for ourselves. So the ideal would be that if a Jewish person saw that the same thing was happening to somebody else, we would also be called upon to be upstanders, because in the tradition of the Sforno, this great Italian commentator, we see all human beings as being created B'Tselem Elokim. In the same way that an older child needs to take care of the younger children, we need to see to it, as best as we can, that we role model and we look after all human beings in whatever way that is. And that's one perspective. I'm going to hand it off now to Rabbi Danishevsky. Any questions, comments, or observations? Yeah, Joel.
Just a question about Italian Jewry. I was in Shul in Italy many years ago. Excuse me. It was very difficult to follow the liturgy. I mean, it was very, very different from what I'm used to.
Okay.
They developed along a different line. Is that
Italian Jews? Yes. So that's something that I alluded to earlier. There were primarily, in Talmudic times, pre-Talmudic times, there were two very significant traditions of practice. One is called Minag Bavel, and one is called Minag Eretz Yisrael. The practice in Babylonia, the practice in Israel. So here's an example of a difference. Today, we observe Simchas Torah. Every year we finish the Torah, 1 year cycle. In Israel, 2,000 years ago, they finished the Torah every 3 years, because they had their own local tradition. Many of the local Minhag Eretz Yisrael, many of the Minhagim, the traditions in Israel, went straight to Italy, did not follow the Babylonian tradition. So let's say traditional Ashkenazi and Sephardi practice predominantly follows the Babylonian tradition, whereas in Italy, many of those Minhagim, many of those customs are going to follow a very different tradition. It's going to look very different. Yeah. And then we're going to pick it up.
We need a little more background on what all of this led up to. Okay. First of all, there were about 43,000 native Italians.
Right. I didn't discuss the influx of Jews who had run.
Right. By 1936 and 1937, Jews are fleeing from areas that the Italians control.
Yeah.
They parceled up Europe between Hitler and Mussolini. There were areas of concern, control. Mussolini and the Italians had the whole Riviera section down to the whole Baltic section, down the whole coast of the Adriatic. Mm-hmm. And the word got out. The word got out, if you were Jewish and you got to either one of these two sections, you would be treated well. You may have to report once a month to the police. You may go to an internment camp where you could marry and get health care, not a concentration camp. These were the places where another 7,000 or 8,000 more Jews managed to get there and be protected from the fascists of Nazi Germany. The fact remains that 84% of the combined communities, Jews, survived. 84%. That should only have been in Lithuania, or should only have been in Holland, or should only have been in any other country in the world. That's an important factor to remember. I know that some Jews were sent to the death camps, but only after the Germans took over, as the rabbi pointed out. In September of 1943, they began to control. The fact that the Italians were out of business.
Right.
And so Jews started getting picked up.
You've
got to remember that.
Yes.
That's very, very important. Because you have people who come down and say, hey, there were fascist laws against Jewish musicians in Italy. And people were thrown out of work, and they couldn't go to the university. I know that, but you never said the same thing about the Polish Jews, did you? What happened in Poland, or in Holland, or in Norway? You never said anything about that. But the Italians, they pick up. There's a famous saying in Italy: a red light is merely a suggestion. There is an option, and the Italians say they will abstain from any kind of inordinate rules on outsiders. They are very much part of that community. It says they're brothers, just as Bartoli said, and just as Toscanini said. They come away from that theory that you can't do the bad things to people and then be considered good.
That's right.
There was another thing I remember when I was in Italy a number of years ago. We were shown the areas in the synagogues and outside of the synagogues where the Italians and the Italian Jews got together and hid sacred Torahs, and everything else, so that when the Nazis finally got in there, it was sort of empty. But the Italian non-Jews contributed to hiding all this stuff.
Amazing.
So what time do we usually go to?
2:30.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me. My name is Yaakov Denishevsky. I've met a couple of you before, book club attendees, which we'll talk about hopefully in a minute. But just to continue on talking about this topic of how does Judaism view nations of the world, view non-Jews, view righteous non-Jews, what is the perspective from Judaism? So that's one perspective. I want to try and explore some other things that I think are really interesting in different sources. I apologize, I lost my voice earlier today at a Ida Crown Jewish Academy Hanukkah party. So I apologize for my voice. It was a good time. Okay, so first of all, just to, you know, Judaism is monotheistic, but it is certainly not monolithic, right? So we believe in one God, but we do not have only one voice in Judaism. There's many, many strands of thought in Judaism, many different commentaries, either from different places in the world, geographically, or from different time periods of human history, of Jewish history. So there's lots of different sources and different things. They don't necessarily all have to be within, they don't have to all be reconciled, right? Sometimes it's actually two different voices, or three or four, five different voices. I always like to comment that in Judaism, on one page of the classic text of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, is a classic text of canonized Jewish law. On one page, you will easily have 12 different commentaries who are all voicing different opinions, right? So there's lots of different opinions in Judaism. So what I'm going to present to you now is one strand of thought. It's one perspective. It's certainly not the exclusive perspective. But to reaffirm what Rabbi Brand was talking about, the opening source here, a verse in Genesis, rather well-known verse, says, "Whoever sheds the blood of man through man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God he made man." And so all of humanity, right in the beginning of the Torah, right in the beginning of the Bible in Genesis, we state very clearly, unequivocally, that Judaism, from a Torah perspective, recognizes the dignity and the image of God in all of humanity. And the question is, how does that play out in different rabbinic sources and later sources, and different halachot, different Jewish laws that come up? And at times, and I imagine many of you have maybe encountered this or heard this or gotten, you know, wind of something like this, there are different Jewish laws that can sometimes seem somewhat insular, right? Somewhat particularized, treating other Jews more favorably, let's say, or somewhat discriminatory or derogatory. I don't want to overplay it, because hopefully not, but from time to time, we'll find something like that in rabbinic literature. And how do we view that? What do we make of that when it's so clear, right off the bat in Genesis, that we understand that all of humanity is made in the image of God and is seen with respect and dignity? How do we reconcile, how do we understand these other sources that we'll sometimes come across? So there's a Christian theologian in a book, I love the title of this book. The book is called, "Is God a Moral Monster?" And the author's name is Paul Copin. He's a Christian theologian. And he is trying to understand, from his perspective, the Old Testament, from my perspective, the Torah, but he's going to the Old Testament. How can we understand God from an ethical perspective in the Torah? When we sometimes find laws, for example, the Jewish people going, the Israelites going into the land of Canaan, and basically genocide, right? Basically wiping out the peoples who lived there when they entered. How do we understand that? Right? And it was a directive from God. So it's very troubling. Right? How do we understand that? We just read that God is saying, everyone's in my image. And now he's commanding the Israelites entering this land to kill people. How do we make sense of that? So Paul Copin's suggestion is the following, if we look in source 2. In the case of the Canaanites, the Canaanites' moral apples didn't fall far from the tree of their pantheon of immoral gods and goddesses. So if the Canaanite deities engaged in incest, then it's not surprising that incest wasn't treated as a serious moral wrong among the Canaanite people. I must have had a typo here, I apologize, because this sentence doesn't make sense. But let's turn to this, I don't know what it should have said, but to this, the bloodthirst and violence of the Canaanite deities. Anath, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, if anyone knows how to pronounce that, the patroness of both sex and war, reminds us of the bloodthirsty goddess Kali of Hinduism, who drank her victims' blood and sat surrounded by corpses. She is commonly depicted with a garland of skulls around her neck. The late archaeologist William Albright describes the Canaanite deity Anat's massacre in the following gory scene, and I just took an excerpt because it gets extremely gory and left out most of it. But the blood was so deep that she waded in it up to her knees, nay, up to her neck. Under her feet were human heads. Above her human hands flew locusts. Her joy at the butchery is described in even more sadistic language. Canaanite idolatry wasn't simply an abstract theology or personal interest carried out in the privacy of one's home. It was a worldview that profoundly influenced Canaanite society. So his argument to make sense of what's going on here in the Torah is that these people who were living there were the most horribly corrupt people. They were, the immorality was through the roof, right? Their gods were corrupt, and they were modeling their gods. So going back to the, you know, one strike or two strikes, this is another strike, right? So the idea of the Israelites coming in and taking over this land was meant to be something that was supposed to enhance humanity. We were basically fighting terrorists. We were basically fighting a branch of humanity that was killing the rest of humanity. So this was actually not so much an attack, but more of a defense for humanity. Basically, in other words, every time period is different and every group is different, but we're basically fighting the Nazis, right? This group of people that we're going into, this was a defense for humanity to wipe out the killing and the murder, the bloodthirsty goddess, right? And her followers. And interestingly, you actually find this sentiment in Jewish sources as well. So this is, like I said, that's the approach of a Christian theologian, Paul Copen. It's actually, to my understanding, that is kind of the mainstream. I don't know if there is a mainstream. I'm not no scholar of Christianity, but there is somewhat of a widespread understanding of how Christianity reads the Old Testament, right? Is that the perspective the Old Testament is taking of nations of the world with that negative outlook is because the nations it's referring to were people who were basically destroying humanity, destroying the world. Yeah.
Are they described this way in the Torah? Or is this...
It's a really good question. No. Yeah, it's interesting. Right? It's interesting. Think about that. Right? Why not? Right? Why not? Make it more clear what we're going after. Right? That's interesting. So in Jewish sources, there is a voice that actually speaks to basically this exact same thing, not with regards to directives in the Torah, but with regards to rabbinic literature. So the Meiri is one of the early authorities, early commentators on the Talmud. He lived from 1239 to 1406. That doesn't make any sense, does it? No.
14.
That can't be. But something around that area in Catalonia. And I meant to put this on in English. I accidentally have only the Hebrew here. I'm not sure what happened. But basically, I just tell you what he says outside. And I will read just the last few lines I'll read to you. The last few words I'll read to you. Basically, he says that many of the laws that appear in the Talmud that would seem to have some level of exclusivity towards Jews, right, treating Jews more kindly or with more compassion than other nations, those laws were only stated with regards to the non-Jews in that time and in the geographic locations they were talking about. This was not meant to be something that was stated as law for Jews to non-Jews always and forever and anywhere. It was specifically in those times when they were living amongst people who were persecuting them, people who were conducting a corrupt and immoral society. And that's why there was a level of resistance, right? It wasn't meant to be derogatory. It wasn't meant to be discriminatory. It was meant to be a level of resistance. Of, we are not going to allow ourselves to indulge and engage in this culture fully. We're going to create a set of laws that keep us apart because we don't want to become prey to this immoral and corrupt society. But when circumstance change and Jews are living in proximity or at a time period where there are righteous and moral societies around them, many of these laws don't apply, says the Meiri. If you're familiar with Hebrew, if you look at just the last few words, the last very few words on reading inside, just because of how specific and how to what extreme he goes with this. He says, Ela harei heim, rather they are, referring to the nations of the world, ki Yisrael gamor. Yisrael, like a Jew, gamor. Gamor means completely. Gemara means entirely. So he says, only when we were talking about those corrupt societies did we create these resistant, insular-focused laws to create some level of distance between us and the society we're with. But when we're in a society that doesn't have this negative influence, Ki Yisrael Gamor L'Dvar Meilu, they are like a full Jew. We treat them with the same compassion, the same respect, and the same laws. So I think that's one interesting perspective. Noting the amount, the range of different views that have occurred in Jewish history, I think that the next source is a really interesting study case, test case. If you look in the Jerusalem Talmud, there is a line that appears as well in the Babylonian Talmud and is codified by Maimonides and is brought down in many different contexts. But there's a very, very slight change in the text that occurs over Jewish history and kind of actually goes back and forth. Sometimes the text appears one way and then it changes and then it'll change again. In different places, it's brought down in different ways. And I'll show you what I mean. So look inside. It says, the reason man was created alone, right? Why did God create the world in the narrative that the Torah tells us? Why did God create the world with just Adam? And then Eve as well, but just Adam to begin with. As one individual. Why create the world with just one individual human being? Says the Talmud, there's a very important reason. The reason man was created alone is to teach that anyone who destroys one life is as if they destroyed the entire world. And anyone who preserves one life is as if they preserved the entire world. The reason that the world is created with just one individual is to send us the very significant message that the entire world is worthy for just one individual. We should treat every single individual life with the fullest importance and the fullest significance, as if the entire world would be worth it for this one individual life. And we can never say, well, it's just one person. Right? The entire world was created for one person. And then more people came, but God wanted to send us that very significant message. But here's the difference in text that sometimes applies. So just to finish that thought, therefore, we should know that when we save a life, we have saved the entire world. If we destroy a life, God forbid, we have destroyed the entire world. But in some texts, it doesn't appear the way I just read it to you. In some texts, it appears, and I'll read it to you the way it appears, the reason man was created alone was to teach that anyone who destroys one Jewish life is as if they destroyed the entire world. And anyone who preserves one Jewish life is as if they preserved the entire world. So it switches it from being universalistic to more particular to the Jewish people. But the original text, the original version of the text, appears without the word Jewish and appears as a fully universal concept and value. And it's interesting to think about, right, when, and I don't have enough of the history to tell you this, but I think it's an interesting experiment to venture into. When exactly did the word Jewish, and where exactly did the word Jewish start creeping into the text? And was that in a context, connecting this back with the perspective I was sharing with you a minute ago, was that in a context where the Jews were being persecuted or in a society in which they did not want to be connected with for moral, spiritual, or other value reasons? And maybe they were trying to kind of shift things a little bit into creating some sort of isolation to not be influenced by that. And there's actually almost, like I said, a form of resistance to the corruption and the immorality. So I don't know the answer to that, but I think it would be really interesting to find out. And it's maybe homework for myself. And if anyone wants to join me, I think it would be an interesting thing to find out. When did that start creeping in? But then it went back. That's the other thing I think is so interesting. So to trace it, right? When did it become more exclusive and particularistic, and when was it more universalistic? But the original text was seeing this, was stating this as a universal concept, universal value. And Maimonides codifies this concept very clearly, right? We talk about figures like Toscanini, Bartal, I think the second one was, right? And others that were mentioned, right? Righteous people who are not observing Jewish laws, right? So what place do they have in Judaism? Maimonides states very clearly in his Laws of Kings, in chapter 8, he writes, second to last source on the page, anyone who accepts upon himself the fulfillment of these seven mitzvot, so referring to the seven Noahide mitzvot, which are basically really just the pillars of an ethical society. There's very, very little ritualistic component to them. There's very little, let's say, Jewish ritualistic feeling to them. They're basically just essential humanism. That's what the seven Noahide laws are. They're basically basic humanism along with belief in a particular God, which from a Jewish perspective is connected to the ethical humanism, right? The monotheistic and ethic humanism is connected because by seeing that there's one God means that the one God who created all of humanity means that all of humanity is equal in its dignity because it was all created by the same God. I'm not created by a different God than someone else, which means that now I can look down upon that person. Right? Monotheism and Jewish ethics are completely intertwined. Right? One is the result of the other. So Maimonides writes, anyone who accepts upon himself the fulfillment of these seven mitzvot and is precise in their observance is considered one of the pious among the Gentiles and will merit a share in the world to come. Very clear, right? This perspective. The Talmud writes about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, one of the greatest sages of the Talmud. Write about him that, and this is meant to be one of the highest praises that they gave him. In addition to all his scholarship, all his knowledge of Jewish law, Jewish philosophy, they said about him that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that no person greeted him before he greeted them. Right, so no one would ever say hello to him before he said hello to them, which I think is really interesting. It's actually a Jewish law that a person should not pass by anyone else without greeting them and saying hello. Isn't that an amazing law? I think that's really cool. So it says about him that he was never preempted in saying hello and smiling or sharing a warm greeting to somebody else, and then it goes out of its way to say even the Gentile in the marketplace. Right? The idea being that this dignity to treat all humans with is clearly stated in these different sources. I think that one of the biggest challenges that we have nowadays for many people is the tension between particularism and universalism, right? Particularism is really important. When I say particularism, I mean the sense of feeling that I belong to a community, that I belong to a certain group, a particular group. And that's a really important thing to have because people need a sense of belonging, right? People need a sense of identity. So we naturally have this drive. Humans have always had this drive for a sense of identity and belonging and community to create groups. And that comes from a very positive and healthy place. We want to feel that we're a part of something, and we're not alone, and we're not just one of endless amounts of people. We are part of something unique and particular. So that's particularism on the one hand. On the other hand, universalism is so important, right? We want to understand and realize the value and the dignity and the need that we have for helping all people, all of humanity. Like we said, all of humanity is created in the image of God. But these two things kind of can get into tension, right? Because if you go all the way into the universalistic side, so then you actually lose some of that feeling of belonging. Because if I'm just one of everyone, then what really is my identity? Where do I belong? We're all just the same, right? We're all just part of one group. So then where is my particularism? And I lose my sense of feeling like I'm a part of a community, a group, that I have a particular unique identity. So I lose that connection. That's what happens if you go towards the purely universalistic side. If you go to the purely particularistic side, you end up with very bad ethics, right? You end up with discrimination, and you isolate the rest of the world. You don't contribute, you don't benefit from, and at its worst, you end up with genocide or terrible things, right? At its best, you end up with just isolationism, right? So there's a real tension here, and I don't have any solutions, but I think that realizing this tension is something that is really important, because I actually think it's kind of at the core of many, many current issues that we as a country, we as a people, we as individuals, we as a community face in many, many different ways, really boils down, at least to me in my own experience, boils down to this really difficult tension of particularism, the sense of identity, the sense of community and belonging to a particular group, and on the other hand, the fact that we live in a global age, which is a blessing, right? That we can care for people on the other side of the world, and we can know the trials and the difficulties of every human being, and to realize how do we bridge those two things? What's the reconciliation of that tension? So I just want to share with you one quote. Excuse me, one quote, and then here we say. C.S. Lewis has a line that I love. It's a tongue twister. C.S. Lewis said that when first things are first things, ready? This is goes back and forth. When first things are first things, and second things are second things, then you have first things and you have second things. But when first things are second things, and second things are first things, then you have neither first things nor second things.
Because they lost their identity.
Exactly. I think, I don't know, I certainly don't know, but I think that what he was trying to say, and what I think the Jewish perspective is that we have to have first things leading into second things. We cannot forget those first things. We have to start with them, but we can't get completely immersed in them that we then forget the second things. I should care, I think ethically, I should care, and it's okay for me to care, more about my immediate family than a stranger. I think that's okay ethically. The problem is if when I'm completely, when I'm caring about my family, I forget that then I'm also supposed to use the fact that it's natural for me to care about my family, I'm supposed to use that to help me develop a sense of compassion and care that I can then move outwards towards other people. Right? I think it's a two-step process. First things need to be first things because that creates that drive, that sensitivity, the empathy, which is natural for me to have to my children. That's natural. I don't have to work on that. That's natural. But then I need to use that, which comes naturally, the first things, and then be able to transfer that to enlarge those who I'm empathetic for. And then that goes out and out in concentric circles. That's the idea of first things and then second things. But if we go to the second things first, and we mix up what's what, we go only universalistic, then we lose all of it. We lose the particularity. And I think if we become completely universalistic, I think we use universalism. We lose universalism, you might say, right? That's the uniqueness of this approach. And I think that's a uniquely Jewish approach, but meant for everybody, right? It means that Jews should be Jews and have certain sense of belonging to that community, but then use that belonging to care about everybody. And other nations should have, and other religions and other faiths should have a sense of belonging to their faith and their community, and then use that to care about everybody. And it all overlaps with each other. I think that's part of the Jewish perspective on this. There's so much more, and it's so complex, but I think that's part of it. Yeah.